Sessions. My theme for the middle hour will be the art of the great guitarist, Andrés Segovia.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this morning by Neil Miners.
It's a classic American story. Burned out of their home and fleeing the Russian pogroms with his family, like millions of other would-be Americans, five-year-old Israel Balin first set foot in the promised land in the strange no-man's land of Ellis Island. He never learned to read or write music. He never needed to. From his late teens, the name of Irving Berlin was a virtual guarantee that a song would be a hit.
Now if you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits?
No one knew more about show business than he did, and he wrote songs for some of the greatest names in decade after decade. Al Jolson, Fred Astaire, Judy Garland, Marilyn Monroe, and of course, Ms. Showbiz herself, Ethel Merman. Irving Berlin as Composer of the Week, weekdays this week at 12 noon at 6:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Now, it's just gone midday and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Matthew Fort is a distinguished food writer and critic and was for 10 years food and drinks editor at The Guardian. His book, Sweet Honey, Bitter Lemons, was inspired by his early love of Italy and Sicily in particular, where his faithful Vespa motor scooter, Monica, used to help him on his quest to sample culinary delights such as almond ice cream and sausage stew, not to mention, I guess, fish.
Oh, grilled fish all the way around, famous for its fish. I mean, they have a wonderfully inventive way of dealing with these supreme fresh ingredients.
Although this book is published quite recently, in fact, it's about your trips in the 70s, because you've done other books. I mean, Eat Up Italy, for example, more recently than that trip.
The Sicilian trip, yes. I went to Italy with my brother Tom in 1973, and I thought then it was the strangest, weirdest, most fascinating place I'd ever been to in my life, and I'd always meant to go back. And 20-odd years later, or 30 years later, I finally managed to get myself organised to do so, and travelled everywhere on a Vespa, because I didn't want to go in a car. It's a car, it becomes a data collecting exercise.
And you don't get the smell of the herbs.
No, the smell of the herbs, the smell of the countryside, the smell of horses and cattle as well. But it's a much more sort of intimate relationship with the physical countryside around. And oddly enough, people find you much less threatening. I think if you're in a car, there's something formal about it. A Vespa, on the other hand, people accept, you know, that this is an everyday event when you stop off the road and chat to them.
Yeah, well, I loved there was a description of you stopping, wanting to trace down the ingredients of some sausages, and you stopped and asked three old men what they ate, which brings us on to a subject later on about class and food and things like that. But one of the butchers who spoke to got quite irate when you suggested what the ingredients might be.
Well, there's this deep, deep passion that I actually find throughout Italy about, you know, the quality and the nature of the local product or ingredient, whatever it happens to be, and to suggest, you know, that the sausages of one village or town are superior or different to the sausages from a town which may be only 5 or 6 kilometres away, just produces these, you know, sense of outrage and indignation, which, of course, you know, this sort of passion for food is what protects Italian food culture, because whether it's right or whether it's wrong is neither here nor there in the end. It is that passion which means that, you know, things stay the same.
I think this passion, from your point of view, began quite early in life, and so did a passion for music, because I think you did have music in your childhood, didn't
yes,
you?
I think probably I inherited my love of both from my father, who's unquestionably, all members of my family inherited the greedy gene from him. He was a very man who enjoyed the good things of life. But also I remember he was the one who put me on the road to music. I remember the very, very first record that I ever had which I think we're going to listen to shortly, which is the Marche Militaire Schubert's, is just one of those ones which immediately appeals to a child. It has that slightly military oompa-pa sense to it. But it's very upbeat, it's very jolly. It's, you know, it reflects the cheery optimism of childhood, I think, wonderfully. It brings back the image of the infant fort, you know, marching round and up and down the room like that. But what strikes me about that is how, actually, what variety there is, even in that sort of ostensibly quite sort of narrow range. There's great gentleness and that wonderful fluid melody.
The Marche Militaire in D Deutsch 733 number 1 by Schubert, played by Christoph Eschenbach and Justus Franz. One piano, four hands. I remember playing that with my father and sometimes happening to play almost musical chairs to get my brother off because he wanted to, he was a couple of years younger, he wanted to play as well.
Well, sadly, we had no such competition because I never learned to play the piano, indeed any instrument. Indeed, I think one of the sort of things I really regret about my life is that I never learned to read music. It's still a language which, you know, is as foreign as Serbo-Croat or Russian to me. And I wish I had now.
But there's great creativity in cooking.
Well, funny enough, I think they're both parallel pleasures, if you like. I mean, you know, a performance exists, there's a piece of music written on a piece of paper, but a performance exists for the time that it exists, and each time you recreate it, and it lasts for that moment. Well, it's the same with dishes. You know, there is the recipe, you know, and you make the recipe, but each time the recipe turns out slightly different, it lasts for the time, you know, that it's in front of you, and then becomes part of your memory, like music does.
Well, it's like performers might sometimes choose, or conductors, to take something just slightly more slowly or slightly more faster on a certain occasion. And in the same way, you might be making some sort of soup and suddenly decide to put in just a little pinch of chilli powder or something to give it a kick.
Yes, no, that's absolutely true. I think, on the whole, I think cooking is a slightly more flexible art form in that you can leave out some of the ingredients whereas you can't.
Well, there are some composers who really would resent having a pinch of chilli thrust into their piece, but there are some conductors I know who have done it. The next piece of music, Matthew Fort, I think talks to you of the English countryside, doesn't it?
Yes, the Finzi Romance. I grew up in Berkshire. I always thought that I grew up in the countryside, although my late mother always said, "Nonsense, darling, it was suburbia." But I have these...
You know,
she was
a headmistress, wasn't she?
She was headmistress of Rodine, yes. Mm-hmm. After my father died, tragically early, she went off and became headmistress of Rodine, having... No, four sons and a newly arrived daughter to cater for. So she did that, and we all went off to school. But a lot of my early childhood memories are associated with wandering around the countryside, going fishing with my brothers, and really spending hours, days, months outdoors. And I particularly love the Finzi piece because, to me, it evokes... it's about the Severn, close to where I now live. I live on the edge of the sort of Severn escarpment in Gloucestershire. But that sense of, you know, the rolling greenness of English countryside, it would be sort of, you know, nostalgic and rather soft-centred, but I don't think actually this piece of music is. I think it, because there is always about the British countryside, and people forget this, there is a hard edge to it. The hardness of agricultural life, the hardness of survival, the hardness of weather, heaven knows. And I think that in a way that Finzi explores this in a particularly English and lyrical fashion.
Thank you.
The Romance for String Orchestra, Opus 11, by Finzi, the City of London Sinfonia, conducted by Richard Hickox. You mentioned, Matthew, how that was quite an unsentimental depiction of English countryside, in your view, in many ways, in that it had a degree of harshness too, and a suggestion of the struggle.
I think possibly the sadness in there's an implicit sadness. There's a wonderful lyrical suite which just takes you away. You just see the sort of railing countryside, but there is always this sort of undercut by, it seems to me, by this note of sadness, this idea of change, that it's not all beautiful sunlit fields.
And that made me think, in a way, of something that comes out quite clearly in your writing, and that is the link between class and food. And people assume, very sadly, that, for example, good food, good cooking, is the preserve of the middle classes.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, and it enrages me to a degree which I find difficult to express. Food has become, possibly always was, the province of the well-educated middle class. And this is quite unlike, it seems to me, other European nations, indeed other nations around the world, where food is part of the common culture. Everybody has access. In Italy, which I know well, in France, everybody has a view on food. Everybody feels that they can say something, you know, that they should be able to eat, go anywhere and eat anything. Whereas in this country, you know, it's been turned into a sort of club. And the other thing about it is that, in fact, you meet a country at its most vivid on the plate. I mean, you know, this is what everybody does. Everybody eats this sort of stuff every day. Now, you go to museums, you go to churches, and what you get is a snapshot. But when the food hits the plate, then you are actually meeting your host nation at the point where everybody comes.
There's a rather extraordinary story, Matthew Fort, attached to our next composer, who in his day was considered the equal of Chopin and Brahms and people like that. He died when a bookcase fell on him. and when they were sorting out the books that were surrounding him, there was great guesswork as to what he might have been reaching for. And one idea was that it was the Talmud that actually was responsible for his demise.
This is Alcock. Yes, he belongs to that wonderful class of the odd death. I think that César Franck was another one who died in rather sort of strange circumstances. He was a sort of rather reclusive figure, a very reclusive figure in the 19th century. And apparently his piano technique was such that even Liszt was supposed to be, seemed to be uncomfortable when watching him play. Whether this is true or not, I simply don't know. But it goes back to a period where I, with my brothers, I shared an absolute passion for virtuoso piano playing. And I think that, in a way, something which has slightly disappeared from the musical scene, the sense of theatre and drama that, you know, possibly pieces of music with not enormous emotional depth, but they can generate, you know, it's a part of the sense of fun. And I remember we became intoxicated, there's no other word for it, by the music of Alcor, thanks to a remarkable American pianist called Raymond Lewenthal, who I think really introduced Alcor to the 20th century. And I can remember him now, you know, the picture on the front of his LP with a sort of great cape, and the collar turned up high above his head, so he looked very dramatic. And I went to a concert that he gave at the Albert Hall, and it was just absolutely fantastic, you know, that sense of theatre, him striding onto the stage, and then everything getting dark, and he just had a standard lamp beside the piano, so everything was focused on
this. This is the equivalent of cooking sort of flambé.
Beyond flambé, I mean. But Alcor himself, and he did produce these colossal works, Vera the Fister, Dizop, and I think there's a symphony for cello piano, and these are sort of mind-boggling complexity. But he also wrote these very, very, very delicate little studies, so that virtuosic playing or virtuoso composing doesn't necessarily mean to be, you know, enormously flashy and, you know, fingers dancing over the keyboards. It can produce something of just, it seems to me, of sort of crystalline imagination.
This in particular, I think, is a very beautiful piece, Song of the Mad Woman on the Seashore.
Chanson de la Folle au bord de la mer. I think it's only 3 minutes long or something, but it's just utterly mesmerising. Thank you.
La Chanson de la Folle au bord de la mer, Song of the Madwoman on the Seashore by Alcan, played by Laurent Martin. I think that the bookcase story is possibly apocryphal because I've heard a newer version, which was that he was found by the maid by the umbrella stand. So, but it's nice anyway. And I mean, it goes with the line of composers who had rather unfortunate and may seem humorous to now, to us, but not to them then. I mean, Berg was stung by a bee, Webern was shot by a soldier by mistake.
And Francis, I think, was run over by a tram when he coughed his false teeth out into the road. That's it's difficult not to laugh at that. Mm. But I much prefer that, I have to say. Whether it's apocryphal or not, I will go on believing that he was crushed to death by a bookshelf.
Now, that was quite a sort of dramatic title, even if it was treated in a very economic way. And, of course, the death was certainly quite dramatic, if we choose to believe that. And it is indeed opera that we come to next, Matthew Faulk.
Yes, well, I think I inherited this passion from my father. But quite early on in my professional career, before I started writing about food, I had the great good fortune. I worked for the Financial Times. And in those days, Lord Droyder, who was chairman of the FT, was also chairman of Covent Garden. And I was responsible for, personally, you know, putting in the FT advertisements into the Covent Garden programme. So I made this my personal mission to go to Covent Garden as often as possible.
And just to make sure they'd printed them properly.
Absolutely, make the right hands, they printed them properly, check the proofs, and incidentally, possibly, just to slip into the stalls and witness dress rehearsals, and occasionally I got tickets for performances as well. And that sort of gave me, I mean, this extraordinary introduction and range. And then this particular piece, I remember there was a performance of La Traviata by the English National Opera with Josephine Bastow's Violetta. And I was so carried away by this particular production, it was during the golden period at the Colosseum, that I went to see it, I think, no less than a dozen times, which is something I've never done anywhere else. And a friend of mine once said about Traviata, said Verdi's sort of ethos as a composer was to aim for the human heart, and in Traviata he hit an absolute bullseye, and from the opening bars of the overture through to the final bars at the end of the opera, I am utterly transported, and I have to have a handkerchief tucked up the sleeve of my jacket because simply to wipe away the manly tears which course down my cheeks throughout the opera.
Well, we're going to hear Ileana Kotrubash singing Violetta, and at what point in the opera would you like us to join it?
Well, it's in the second act, when Germont's father comes to persuade her to give up her lover for the sake of family honour and for the sake of the marriage of his sister, if I remember rightly. And there's this long sort of dialogue between the two as the emotional blackmailing mounts and mounts and mounts, and he's utterly, utterly heartbreaking, I find.
And in fact, Verdi is always particularly potent, I think, when you've got a kind of father-daughter relationship or father-in-law relationship with a daughter. I think there's something that touched him very personally about that.
Yes, I think of Rigoletto, which is another sort of a masterly exploration of this. It's a gender politics of the time, and in that sense, I think that Verdi was remarkably ahead of his time. But it's always portrayed in profoundly human terms, and it is that which I find moves me every time. That is heartbreaking.
It is. And it's extraordinary the way Verdi, when Germont sings Piangi, Piangi, Piangi o misera, Piangi, weep, unhappy girl, weep, the orchestra sighs, doesn't it? It's like a human sigh.
Like a little breath there behind it. I also think, I sadly never saw Elena Kotrova singing this, but I think it's absolutely a fabulous piece of singing. I mean, very, very soft the second time she comes in, and it's a very, very, very soft singing. It's just utterly, you know, you acting with the voice in the most extraordinary way, and that you can understand the emotional argument there, and why she ends up to this extraordinary level of self-sacrifice by the end of the act.
Music from Act Two of Verdi's La Traviata. We heard Elena Kotrubash singing Violetta and Cheryl Milnes singing Germont with the Bavarian State Orchestra conducted by Carlos Kleiber. We're going now, I think, I would say, Matthew, to the complete reverse of the flambé pianist.
Dino Lipatti. Yes, I remember being introduced to Lipatti's recordings by a friend of mine when I went to America in, seems to be an almost impossibly long time ago now, in 1968-69. And the very first time I heard his records is that there's something about the quality of the pianism is that there's almost a complete absence of a sense of the player. I mean, there's a sort of translucency of technique where nothing comes between you and the music. Everything is so beautifully controlled and graded, been so completely thought through. And the emotional, again, the emotional argument, it seems to me, in all the pieces he's played, it's just this utterly beautiful distillation, I think, of what piano playing should be.
People that heard him never forgot his playing. And sadly, of course, he died very young of leukemia. And this, actually, this recording of the Mozart piano sonata in A minor, which we're going to hear, the Andante, was in fact recorded his last recital in Besançon in 1950, I think.
It was a famous concert. Part of the concert was taken up with the Chopin waltzes, and he was too ill and he couldn't complete them and he had to be helped off the stage. But the Mozart he actually recorded twice. He recorded early in his career. And what is interesting is the fabulous, beautiful playing is still the same. But it seems to me that there's an enormous change in the sort of emotional emphasis within the music itself. And the first one is, here is a man in full health, bloom of relative youth, and just in utter command of his technique, and with the glorious future beckoning him. And then the second version is when he knows that he's dying. And it seems to me that the music is infused both with two things. There's an urgency in part of the music, which is as if he's somehow got to get this done before he dies. And at the same time, there is this sort of exploration of death. And maybe this is my imagination, because one knows the conditions under which he actually made this recording or did this concert. But I don't think I'm being too fanciful. There's a sort of three-way process going on, isn't there? There's the composer composing the music, there's the performer performing his version of it, and then there's the listener, the hearer, interpreting in relation to their own life experiences and their own expectations and their own, I suppose, character as well. And that's what makes it such a wonderfully rich medium.
The Andante from Mozart's Piano Sonata in A Minor, Kirkel 310, played by Dino Lipatti. Curiously enough, Matthew Fort, that was his last recital. And the singer that you're going to introduce me to now, I think you went to her last concert.
I think it was. This is Mercedes Sosa, who's one of the great giants of modern Argentinian music. I came across her in a sort of rather roundabout and extraordinary way. I saw a series of documentaries on the BBC about the guitar music of South America, and one of them was devoted to the guitar music of the Pampas, of the Gauchos. And it's one of the very, very few films I've ever seen that actually made me want to take up an instrument. It was just, I found it so mesmerising and moving, really. Anyway, I didn't take up the guitar. The world would be relieved to hear. But I started looking around for music of this sort in record stores and so on. And I couldn't find any. Eventually, I found this CD from Argentina, which had this picture of this rather stout fellow on the front holding a guitar. And his name was Atahualpa Yupanqui. And just the name itself, I had to buy it. And then through another long involved process, I was eventually got this tape that someone, a friend, had put together of Mercedes Sosa singing the songs of Atahualpa Yupanqui. And while driving through France one year with my daughter Lois, the only music we had in the car was this tape, which we played over and over again. And we became absolutely, completely carried away by it. And eventually she came, I think she must have been in her 70s, to do a concert at the Festival Hall. And it was absolutely packed. It was one of the most extraordinary concerts I've ever been to. I think that everybody in the audience but us actually knew every word of every song. But I understood the meaning of the word majesty for the first time in my life. This woman came onto the stage, not very tall, rather stout, wearing a beautiful flowing cape and boots and some sombrero-type hat. And immediately she started to sing, I just felt the voice sort of punches through the sort of solar plexus, grabs you by the heart and holds you there. I couldn't understand a word she was singing. I don't speak Spanish. But, you know, I just felt this was really an extraordinary performer.
Dicha busco, vivo penando, y cuando debo quedarme vida, me voy andando, y cuando debo quedarme vida, me voy andando. A veces soy como el río, llego cantando y sin que nadie lo sepa, vida, y me voy llorando y sin que nadie lo sepa, vida, y me voy llorando. Es mi destino, piedra y camino de un sueño lejano y bello, vida, y soy peregrino de un sueño lejano y bello, vida, y soy peregrino.
Ravishing.
I don't know what you might make of that.
Yeah, no, I thought it was beautiful. Pedra y Camino by Atahualpa Yupanqui, sung by Mercedes Sosa. And it occurred to me as we were listening to that how those sort of voices, Cesaria, Evora, or even Billie Holiday in a way, embody the earth almost of their native country in the same way that certain foods do.
Yes, now I think that's true. I mean, I was listening to that, I thought it occupies a very different world than the Lipatti, for example, and yet there is also sort of nobility about it. And it's that nobility, in this case, I think, of being rooted in a tradition and in a culture and in that sense of place. I mean, she led, a fairly sort of a difficult life, and she was lived outside Argentina for a number of years for political reasons. And it seems to me that an awful lot of Argentine music or songs are either about love, death and politics, and frequently all three at the same time. And they are pretty fundamental, you know, I think, in this case. But I also love the sort of voluptuous richness of the voice that comes across.
And she's able to inflect it with great sadness.
Yes.
What about, finally, composers as gastronomes?
Yes. Well, I wanted to end up on a sort of upbeat note. And Rossini. And Rossini was... You know, how can you not love a man, you know, who had one of the great dishes of the world named after him, which he helped develop himself? There are many things I love about Rossini. One of the stories about it was that, you know, he wore a wig. Now, a wig is normally a sign of vanity, but apparently he used, in winter, he'd wear two wigs, one on top of each other, to keep his head warm. So clearly it wasn't just vanity. But my favourite story of all is the one about Rossini said he only ever cried three times in his life. First time was when his mother died. The second time was when he heard Paganini play the violin. And the third time was when the truffled turkey he was about to eat fell off the boat on which he was picnicking. And I, you know, frankly, my heart goes out to him. And he was, you know, he was a man who loved life and lived life and wrote some the most delightful and beguiling music, I think, you know, for both opera. Everybody knows about him as an opera composer, but the Sonata a Quattros that he wrote when he was 11, so he claimed, I mean, almost incredible when you hear the music. And he wrote them in a very, very short space of time, like 5 or 6 days or something like that. And yet they show such all the sort of invention and musicality and lightness of touch and humour that you associate with his mature operas.
Thank you.
Oh, the dancing good humour of that.
Well, I was just thinking, we've had a rather wonderful and rich meal, and that's like a glorious light souffle pudding or something.
A little something to finish up with. I think you should always end up on an upbeat, as I hope every good meal would do.
Now, the Sonata Quattro number 3 in C, the third movement we heard, Moderato by Rossini, performed by I Musici. And finally, Matthew Fort, it occurred to me that in a sense, what Rossini was proving there was probably what you would say about most cooking, and indeed drink, that it's all variation on an original theme.
Oh, yes. I think there are no great new ideas, but it's a wonderful business exploring what all those variations might be.
Matthew, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Matthew Fort was talking to Michael Barclay. Well, next weekend we celebrate the Queen's Diamond Jubilee, and Michael's guest on Private Passions will be the poet laureate Carol Ann Duffy. That's next Sunday at the same time, midday. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. The producer of today's programme was Chris Marshall. Well, in a couple of minutes, the early music show Lucy Skeeping presents highlights of a concert given by the early music ensemble L'Estravagante, exploring the art of the violin in Rome and Venice, and featuring music by Corelli and Vivaldi. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock and time for the news, read by David Cornett.
Labour have called for an independent investigation into an accusation that the Conservative Party co-chairman, Lady Varsi, claimed accommodation expenses while living at a house rent-free. The landlord of the property in West London said he never received any money from the peer or discussed the matter with her. Lady Varsi argues that she made payments to a friend living in the house. The Syrian government has denied killing more than 90 people, a third of them children, in a town near Homs. The international community had strongly condemned the attacks. A foreign ministry spokesman blamed terrorists and said a committee had been set up to investigate the deaths. He said the government faced a tsunami of lies, insisting that there had been no government tanks in the town of Hola. About 250 demonstrators have gathered in a park near Harpenden in Hertfordshire, a mile from where genetically modified wheat is being grown as part of a trial. They've been barred from the test site and police are protecting the area. The campaigners say nearby crops could be contaminated. The scientists argue that the risks are infinitely small. The world's leading insurance provider, Lloyds, says it's made contingency plans for the collapse of the euro. The chief executive of Lloyd's Insurance Market, Richard Ward, said the group was ready to deal in drachma if the Greeks leave the single currency after next month's general election. Police in Greater Manchester are questioning four people about the murder of a 23-year-old man who was shot dead at a party in a pub in Droylsden on Friday. Three other men were wounded during the attack. State television in Iran has reported that the government is planning to construct a new nuclear power plant. It'll be built alongside the country's existing nuclear site in the southern city of Bushehr. A spokesman said work could begin next year. And the weather, it'll be fine in most places with almost unbroken sunshine this afternoon, but a band of rain is moving through southwestern areas. Tomorrow will be cloudier. BBC News and Weather at 1:02.
And it was read by David Cornett. Time now on Radio 3 for today's early music show. Here's Lucy Skeeping.
Welcome to the show, and highlights today from a concert given earlier this year in the historic Capuchin Church in the Swiss town of Freiburg. The performers are the Italian ensemble L'Estravagante, two violins, cello and harpsichord, and their programme explores the early violin repertoire with sonatas by two of the most influential composers in Italy, where it all began at the turn of the 17th century, Vivaldi and Corelli, who we're going to hear first. This is the last violin sonata he wrote, a set of variations on the old tune known as La Follia.